Hello there, old patron. Welcome, new patron. This is a three article in which the three of us bring articles to discuss. It's a bit of a show and tell. The way it works, for those of you who are not familiar, if this is your first month with us, welcome once again. We each bring an article to discuss, and hopefully they cohere around a central theme. This month, the discussion is about, let's say broadly speaking, the durability of right populism. And we've got cases looking at Brazil-US relations, at the US itself, and at Britain. So without further ado, I will hand over to George, who's going to talk about his article. He's up first.
Thanks. Yeah, so I picked from this weekend's FT, Red Wall voters remain faithful to Conservatives, which is not really a sort of breaking story, but it's it addresses some of the big questions about the disruptive medium-term political impact of COVID. And so basically what they've done is they've taken this place in the West Midlands called Dudley, or I'll try and do the accent, Dudley. That's the, which actually,
thanks for that.
George, that was really good. Well done. You've alienated all of our Red Wall listeners. Like those are the people that we reach out to and that we love, George. And you've just alienated all of our Red Wall supporters.
There was a study which showed that the West Midlands accent was the one that non-English speakers found the nicest of all the regional British accents, including Irish and as well, which is often
okay. Good save,
the nicest one. Yeah, good save. I
so tell us what the Red Wall is.
Yeah. So actually, to get into the meat of it a little bit, it's an extension of this narrative, this idea of the Red Wall, which is the ex-Labour heartlands. I mean, the heartlands is another way to describe this set of kind of Midlands, Northern constituencies who already in 2017 in Dudley, there was only 22 votes in it. So it was really, really close. And then the Conservatives won this constituency for the first time in 2019. So it's one of these kind of, I guess you would say, a bellwether, or kind of, it's the place that journalists who, when they leave London, like to go to get some local colour. And there's a picture of a market and some people accompanying the article. But anyway, what's it about? It's basically that the opinion poll, there was an opinion poll by Comrades last week, which suggested that essentially the Tories' support is back where it was pre-COVID. So I think there was a lot of questions, and even we had some discussions about this. What will be the impact politically of coronavirus? Is this going to be the end of neoliberalism? Is it going to be this kind of place for the left to charge into this space? And it looks already quite quickly that things are returning to, in at least some aspects, to the way they were prior to essentially March of this year. So yeah, I think that's the main takeaway from this, is essentially things are back already to some degree of normal in some places where there was, I think the left or Labour in the UK might have thought, okay, let's have a look at these places and see if there's anything we can do to try and make some hay with the narrative that the Tories have mismanaged coronavirus. So yeah, I just found it very, very interesting, and I think this is something which I'd, not like, oh, here's vindication of what I'd said previously, but this is something that I'd said before on the podcast, which is that I don't think there's going to be, it's not straightforward that there's going to be lasting political change as a result of coronavirus. It doesn't work that simply and straightforwardly.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. So the article is by Sebastian Payne, who's, kind of reasonably decent, I think, reasonably decent reporter on matters such as these. And it has some other points which I think are worth drawing out as well. The fact that Corbyn seemed to be so important to the kind of the people who were interviewed, at least, as well as what was said in the polls. The fact that he was seen to be anathema to these voters. It's kind of pro-military, old-fashioned kind of Labour, patriotic, and this is what put them off. But also specifically, and one person who was interviewed for it also mentioned specifically the fact that Corbyn flip-flopped on Brexit. That was such an important marker for them. And on top of that, the other interesting point, which I think is which is drawn out in the article, is the significance of Boris Johnson's new chancellor, Rishi Sunak, who's Asian, as you can tell from the name, but his association with managing the coronavirus crisis, they're kind of the attempts that they've put in to support the flagging economy, the furlough scheme, kind of wage support, financial support to businesses, all of this is drawn out as making him a popular figure, but also someone that makes it a kind of an electoral combination, which is that kind of Boris Johnson can appeal to with his kind of bombastic and kind of supposedly down-to-earth style. He can appeal to red wall voters for being kind of shooting from the hip and straight talking, whereas the more dulcet tones of Sunak, he'll appeal to voters in Surrey. So the more liberal wing of Tory voters who might be repulsed by the more populist aspects of the Johnson government and his anti-EU stance, they will be brought back into the fold and consolidated through Sunak. And so that the Tories have two figures who embody the new kind of cross-class coalition, working class voters in the former Red Wall and home counties voters who will be consolidated by Sunak. So I thought that was also a good point from the piece.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not sure about the prognostic aspects or the suggested kind of prognostics of the piece, which is to say, I think a lot could change. And I probably disagree a bit with George here, just in terms of the political impacts of coronavirus. I don't mean that it's going to be necessarily propitious for the left or anything like that, but I think the impact of it is going to be so significant. We haven't really, I think we're underestimating the severity of what's still to come and still to become totally manifest, I think. Because, you know, you have these horrific kind of GDP figures, but then you think, well, it'll bounce back. So, you know, it'll be kind of quickly resume kind of growth. But I'm skeptical about that. And I think that will have certain political impacts. What I think we can draw on probably a bit more solidly from this article is looking backwards and the story that one could tell about what happened to Labour, both in a long-term sense and also specifically what happened under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the party. And as George said in the introduction, a place like Dudley is a bit kind of bellwether. You know, for American listeners, you could think of a kind of mid-sized town in Rust Belt, Pennsylvania or Ohio or something like that, which would kind of capture more or less kind of the type of place we're talking about, I suppose. But so the thing that I wanted to draw out is that there's a long-term, in places like Dudley, there's a long-term decline in the Labour vote, both as in absolute terms, which is of a piece with the kind of wider withdrawal from public electoral politics, lower turnout rates and so on, kind of looking over the long term, but also in relative terms that Labour has been losing relatively to Conservatives and other parties over the past, you know, 20 years. So that was already clear, but Labour did win the seat very, very narrowly in 2017. That was still under Jeremy Corbyn. So the idea that suddenly Jeremy Corbyn's kind of, I guess, identification or the way that Jeremy Corbyn is identified with, you know, to put it in the really cliche terms, like liberal, metropolitan, elite, blah, 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 kind of vegetarian, organic, all that kind of stuff. You know, color in the lines, the rest of the depiction yourself.
Vegetarian, organic stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you get the picture,
right? That's literally
right?
What it said on all the campaign posters.
But, you know, those voters were still willing to vote for him, or at least a majority or a plurality in that constituency were still willing to vote for Corbyn. What happened in the interim, you know, Brexit, and this is something that we highlighted in our post-election episode at the end of 2019, but also this idea of Corbyn himself being seen as untrustworthy, unpatriotic, which I think is partly a product of kind of the media bombardment that he received over the past kind of 2 years, you know, since, after the 2017 election and especially in the recent period. But I think that what really shows up is how deadly that Brexit decision was. As Phil highlighted, one of the interviewees mentioned it.
I mean, that's exactly what made all these kind of claims about Corbyn's lack of leadership, I guess, hit with voters, because that was obviously a narrative that the media have been pushing for a long time. But if you basically the major political issue, it's not clear what your position is. And then to the extent that it's clear, you change it. and you go against them, go against the vote, then I mean that is always going to be terminal. And yeah, I mean that's a very clear difference between 2017 and 2019. I think it is an interesting sort of part of the country as well. I mean, one thing which I didn't realize which is highlighted in the piece is that up until 1976, this, you know, Black Country manufacturing trade, so this is like the West Country, made it the richest place in Britain per capita, higher than London, higher than the Southeast.
Output. So that was actual kind of industrial production.
It's an area which had a lot of wealth and a lot of centrality to the British economy, and now it's kind of a looked down upon, sort of despised place by, I would say, the London politicos. And
it's so an astonishing.
I'm
just going to say it's an astonishing kind of. It's so the factory George just mentioned about how wealthy it was in the late 70s is something mentioned by the former Labour MP for the constituency who's interviewed in the piece. And it's an astonishing statistic. I mean, it tells you just how, I mean, George is being fairly generous, I think, in describing how that town would be viewed. The fact in how much the kind of economy, the regional economy, the national economy in England has polarized in the last 40 years, that really tells you something, that from 1976, richer per capita output terms than London. And in the wake of the kind of growing financialization of the British economy, Thatcherism, all of the rest of it, Blairism, globalization, blah, 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 that it's now kind of that kind of small town, Rust Belt, which is kind of despised by the latte drinking classes. That, you know, it's Mate. Really striking.
Yeah, except for latte drinking classes, as it points out that, you know, as one of the Labour, I think, mayors in the area, or ex-MP rather, points out that, you know, maybe people didn't want their kids working down the mines anymore, but they're also not terribly happy about it. The only jobs being on offer is at the Costa Coffee. So people are drinking latte outside of, you know, central London. I just want to illustrate that.
Why are you standing up for the latte drinking classes? Maybe they're drinking...
No, I'm standing up for latte. I'm just saying latte is far more popular now. No, man. I hate these little characterizations, actually, like Red Wall as well, how it just becomes this kind of little over-repeated sort of talking point, and as if it sums up so much information in one thing, and it means that knowledge is never really interrogated.
It's true. It's the same, you know, with like Rust Belt is also,
yeah,
you know, it's deep, on the one hand, it's kind of deeply patronizing to Midwestern, you know, citizens, voters, whatever. At the same time, you know, it does capture something about deindustrialization, and it becomes a kind of cliched shorthand. And the Red Wall, you know, if you look at kind of an electoral map of Britain before 2019, there's a really thick band of Labour seats. One part, you know, there were one party statelets between Scotland and southern England. And so, you know, I mean, it's a cliché, but on the other hand, it does capture something which is evocative and effective.
It's annoying but useful. but yeah, I think just... like
so many of us.
But I think just to return to this point about, I guess, the what's the nature of the coalition that the Tories are trying to develop and protect. So it's Surrey and Dudley. So Surrey, for perhaps listeners who aren't that familiar with the south of England, very, you know, very affluent, sort of semi-rural, but you can get to London pretty quickly.
It's Connecticut for American listeners.
Yeah, you can drive 10 minutes and go and get on your boat on the Thames, or you can drive, you know, 15 minutes and get on the train and get into London for your job. But it's not London. So this is a coalition which excludes the metropolis, which could have a lot of interesting distortions in British politics, because I think that's the way, that's the kind of traditional Tory heartland. And so they're reconfiguring how to kind of do this geographically. And I think you're going to see a lot of perhaps more or less populist moves of an anti-London, anti-latte drinking classes bent British politics. So yeah, be careful. If you're a fan of lattes, you're going to get a shellacking from the Tories.
All right, shall we move on to the next one?
Which is yours. Tell
is
us.
It mine? Okay. Right, so mine
That's
is...
That's a good rhetorical question to ask. Should we move on to the next one? Yes, we should, because it's mine.
I was waiting. No, I was waiting for affirmation. Right, so my article is in the New York Times. Lawmakers...
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Sorry, just before we do move on, I just wanted to, so if you guys won't have seen this because you read it online. I read the actual paper version. And sorry, just to point out, it's on page 2, this story. And then directly right underneath it, in much smaller, is statistical agency recognises full nationalisation of railways. The de facto nationalisation of Britain's railways has been formally recognised after the statistical agency and train operators said train operators' debts would be counted on the government's balance sheet. So it's kind of, you know, just this is the mood music. This is the sort of thing that you're going to be reading. I just thought it was.
No, it's good.
It's an interesting little chaser after the main story. But yeah, that's an interesting context. Sorry to interrupt, though, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, the nationalization is not proper nationalization, I suppose. It's a, you know, statistical quirk because all their kind of losses have been socialized. Anyway, that's maybe for another time. So this article is in the New York Times. It is by Ernesto Londoño, Manuela Andreoni, and Leticia Casado. Actually, she's probably Brazilian, so I pronounced that wrong. Anyway, whatever. It's lawmakers alarmed by reports U.S. envoy told Brazil it could help re-elect Trump. The story is about the fact that Trump seems to be, via his ambassador in Brazil, putting pressure on Brazil to accept larger imports at zero tariffs of ethanol, which Brazil produces a lot of. It produces probably about 80% or something of its needs, but it imports more, an additional tranche from the U.S. And the U.S. and Brazil are the two biggest ethanol producers by far in the world. They account for like 80% or something of global production. On the one hand, on face value, it just seems a bit of dodginess on Trump's part, basically trying to put pressure on his Brazilian partners to change their tariff barriers for immediate electoral advantage. Basically, it's to help ethanol producers in places like Iowa so that they can remain part of his, or so they'll choose to remain part of his electoral base. So that's dodge, and it's been called out by this by the House Foreign Relations Committee. At the same time, there's an element of kind of Russia-gating Brazil on this, which is, I tweeted this the other day, I think it's completely absurd, but whatever, we live in ridiculous times, and it's not completely unimaginable that this should also become a thing. So this is a kind of story that's been tacked on to this main story, but it's that Eduardo Bolsonaro, who both his father, the president, had nominated to be even becoming ambassador to the U.S., which was then denied. But anyway, he's one of Bolsonaro's sons, and he tweeted out a video like pro-Trump 2020, calling for Trump's re-election and so on. Obviously, they're very close, and the whole Bolsonaro project is very closely tied to Trump and Trump remaining in the White House, I think, just because this government is so... It runs on pure ideology, let's put it that way. If ever there was an attempt to run a government on pure ideology, it was this one, because a lot of its kind of electoral coalition is fragmenting. The Bolsonaro government's remarkably weak, but there's also a kind of inertia, so there's nothing really able to dislodge it right at the moment. And as a consequence, it's quite dependent on the kind of ideological reinforcement of having a kind of similar figure in the White House. So there's kind of a lot going on here. I guess highlight the three themes that I think are more important. I guess you could say, on one hand, it's kind of a corruption of the Republic, if you believe in such a thing, both in the U.S. and in Brazil. It's the things that Democrats like to accuse Trump of, and in this regard, they're maybe sometimes correct in terms of not following the kind of forms of decorum, as well as the kind of supposed impartiality that the president should have in terms of not privileging his own electoral future or his own private interests in favor of the kind of the greater good. But likewise, you can see the same thing in the U.S. with the Bolsonaros, who are so tied to the U.S., these supposed nationalists who basically just want to not make Brazil great again, but make Brazil part of the U.S. as much as possible. And so that relationship of dependency is something that comes out very clearly in this article, as well as the questions of Russiagate, in the idea that foreign influence is, especially from a kind of relatively unimportant state like Brazil, is able to influence U.S.'s internal affairs, which I think... Phil will talk about in his article. But anyway, any comments on that?
I had one
just on ethanol, because I was, so when we were in Brazil, I was quite struck by how prevalent it is, not just in drinks, but obviously it's 3/4 of cars.
What does that mean?
Are you slagging off our the cachaça that we had, mate? That was actually not bad stuff.
It's great stuff. No, but 3/4 of cars in Brazil use a mixture of ethanol and gasoline. So it's quite an important product for Brazilian life, which I don't think it, you know, I don't, well, actually I should ask you, Alex, you're the, you know, our man on the ground there. Does it have a bit more of a kind of a resonance as an important good for import and export?
Yeah. I mean, Brazil has made very important advances in agronomy, and in these sort of in related areas over the past 40 years or so. It's probably one of the few things that Brazil can point to as a real kind of technological and productive success. And ethanol is one of them, in not being reliant on petroleum as much. For decades now, all car gasoline has to be mixed at least 20% ethanol. And in your car, you know, most cars are like flexi cars, so you go and fill up your car at the tank, and you can choose ethanol or petrol or diesel, and most cars can take both. So it's obviously an important product, but the fact that Brazil still has to import some when it should be able to be fully self-sufficient in it, I think, is damning. And the fact that the Bolsonaro government, you know, doesn't really have kind of any industrial policy in that regard, and rather what it wants to do with this ethanol thing, which is an element which I didn't raise from, I think it comes out in the article, which is that in trying to lower tariff barriers and basically allow basically producers in Ohio to export more ethanol to Brazil, it would be so that the U.S. Repays in kind and allows more soy and beef in from Brazilian exports. But, you know, I think that whole story has to be put in the context of severe deindustrialization that Brazil has undergone over the past decades, such that it's very dependent on agricultural exports, which then themselves are subject to fluctuations in price, which makes it very vulnerable to economic crises, which is what happened in mid part of the last decade with the end of the commodity super cycle. So I think in that regard, it's really damning, because Brazil is kind of classic kind of middle income trap problem there, of not being able to compete on wages with somewhere like China, or, you know, even more so Vietnam now, or somewhere like that, while at the same time not really having the capacities for kind of real industrial development, and is becoming subject to deindustrialization, which is kind of, you know, a rich world problem, but which also affects a kind of middle income country like Brazil.
So I suppose the things I wanted to add to it, I thought it was actually a remarkably good article, only in the sense that it's actually proper reporting. And I guess that tells in the fact that it's all, I mean, as far as I can tell, the reporters are all on the bylines are all Brazilian. And I suppose so. It's good in the sense that it's, kind of a fairly detailed and granular account of the interlocking, both interlocking political constituencies and national economic interests around agro exports and imports that tie together various sections of the Brazilian and US political elite, tied into two presidents, two kind of right populist presidents, both of whom are flagging in the polls or struggling with their future electoral chances. And I thought it was just a really good kind of piece to which tied together, you know, detailed, lots of quotes and links to particular, particular individuals and how they're kind of caught up in the story. So I thought, you know, strikingly, you know, yeah, just a really good read, actually, and good old fashioned journalism.
I'm not sure I'd entirely agree, because it doesn't have any actual like evidence. It's, here are some stories which the Brazilian media reported, and this means that Trump's bad. That's essentially my take, my simplistic reading of it. Because
no, I disagree.
Any,
I think that's
any evidence that they,
they've talked to people
about what Todd Chapman said.
They've talked to okay, I grant you that, but I mean they've you know they give you some information and background about the detail of the two kind like agro import export. They've got statements from people, right? From people. It's true they don't have like a smoking gun, and obviously it's in the New York Times, so it's going to be framed in a particular kind of way. But okay, maybe I don't want to make you know as maybe my claim is a bit overblown, but you know I still stand by it that it's kind of there's elements here of good old fashioned reporting, which I guess I'm not used to seeing. It stuck out because it seems to me so rare increasingly when you read. When you open kind of the major papers of record in the West now, I'm not sure
maybe
I go so far.
Your expectations are just too low.
Maybe so. I was going to say I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say they're going to Russiagate Brazil, because I don't think that kind of Brazilian, you know, I don't think you can kind of crank up Brazilgate the
same way
that you can with Russia, given you know you can always kind of fall back on Cold War kind of tropes to. For that story to kind of, to carry that story here, it's more kind of nefarious links between kind of you know someone who's to the right of Trump, which is the Brazilian president, and kind of you get to tar Trump with the same brush by their ideological affiliation and their the way in which they've politically bonded, and particularly the way in which, like you say, Alex, Bolsonaro has kind of pathetically latched onto Trump, given his given the kind of peculiar characteristics of the Brazilian elite and their weird kind of, I don't know how you'd call it, but
well,
their weird
there's a
quasi-nationalism.
Term. Well, there's a term here in Brazil, which is really important, which was coined in the 50s, but it's called vira-lachismo or mongrel syndrome. I think we've talked about it on the podcast before, way back when. But it's the kind of idea that in Brazil, especially elites, but it, you know, it filters down into the middle class. This idea that Brazil is just doomed, basically, that it's no good, and this kind of looking at everything in Brazil through shit tainted glasses, to coin a term. I don't know what you'd say the opposite of rose tinted glasses are, but you know, basically seeing everything in Brazil like, oh, this is we're the most corrupt, nothing ever works, we can't get anything done, like everyone Brazilians are lazy, and it's basically a way of loathing not just your compatriots, but really kind of looking down on the Brazilian masses as kind of holding Brazil back, and a desire to be the US and to view yourself as being, you know, North American, basically, to be as wealthy and just to feel like, well, why aren't we able to do what the US is able to do? You know, we should strike free trade deals or something like that.
It's a country with low self-esteem.
Yeah.
It strikes me it's a common syndrome among the middle classes of middle income countries, because it's common.
Absolutely.
Among the southern tier of the EU as well, looking up to kind of France and Germany and Holland and so on. But I think, you know, I mean, obviously, you know more than I do about it, Alex, but it seems to me with Brazil, it goes further, because it seems like it's hard to embarrass them on being, you know, it's hard to embarrass the Brazilian right on being insufficiently nationalistic. Like, that just doesn't seem to land somehow in a way that I think it would in places, you know, like, I don't know, Greece or Spain or Italy. Whereas the Brazilian elite seem to be completely inured to charges of, somehow it doesn't seem to stick as much because they don't even have kind of a sufficient sense of their own national independence to be prickly about being seen to be overly dependent on foreign allies in a way that I think other elites do.
Well, because they don't have a notion, because for all their nationalism, it's for domestic consumption, the nationalism, basically. It's to say, we, the elite, are Brazil, and you, the masses, are trash. So it's not an external-facing kind of nationalism so much. I mean, of course, there are kind of elites who will be embarrassed about Brazil looking bad on the global stage. In fact, that's one of the reasons that a lot hated Lula, because they thought they were embarrassed by the fact that he didn't speak English and, you know, whatever, his... made grammatical errors in Portuguese and all this kind of stuff, you know, the kind of usual snobbery. But I think it also tells a story about kind of nationalism, right-wing nationalism under neoliberalism, especially in a kind of dependent country like Brazil, where you don't have the kind of nationalism of the 70s, where although it was very closely, you know, the military dictatorship was very closely tied to the US, there was still a sense of, hang on, we're responsible for our own affairs, we're going to undertake kind of development policies, including import substitution and so on. Whereas today, it's completely kind of the elites are completely globally oriented. So the nationalism discourse is really just a way of distinguishing themselves from the masses at home, but without really pursuing any kind of nationalist policy in practical terms, whether it's national development or maybe building up the military against a foreign enemy or anything like that. There isn't any of that. It's a symbolic nationalism.
I guess I just had a couple of quick points on this, on the article, which I think are more on what it says about America probably than what it says about Brazil. And the first is just, this is, you know, the distorting global impact of the American election season and how many things are going to be linked to more or less directly to, you know, what could happen in that election and what Trump's strategy is going to be. We still don't have a very clear idea of what his pitch is going to be. Is he going to be a deals guy? Is this going to be kind of, you know, his way of selling himself to the American people? It seems like he's left that too late, though, on the whole. And just a second point, to return to your idea of a Brazil gate, Alex, if they're getting in, the New York Times getting in their excuses early for Biden losing, it could be, you know, Russiagate, Cold War tropes. You know, you can say all sorts of things about Russian villains, but if there is a Brazil gate, it will be based on corruption and things like this. Like you can sort of see it maybe starting to develop, like backroom deals. You have the corrupt Trump administration and various appointees, and then corrupt kind of foreign governments colluding. So it's not a case of too much force and sneakiness of the Russians and their computer tech savviness, but a question of the corruptness of Brazil or whoever else is going to be the external agent who will influence the election. I think there's you know, something to say if this does end up happening, that we said it first, although it's not seen quite.
Well, no, that's right. I mean, I tweeted the other day, like, oh, that they're going to Russiagate Brazil, kind of jokingly. But, you know, the House Foreign Affairs Committee, the chairman, Representative Elliot Engel, said, we've seen this playbook before. It's disgraceful and unacceptable. The Bolsonaro family needs to stay out of the U.S. election. Right? So the same language as with regard to Putin and Russia. Everyone's getting their excuses in early. Let's put it that way, which actually is a nice segue onto our last piece, which Phil is going to introduce.
Yeah. So this is a piece from the New Statesman, kind of a left-leaning political weekly in the UK. And it is called Imagine the Damage a President Would Cause. What would happen if Trump refused defeat? ? And it is one of their journalists called Emily Tamkin talking to U.S. legal scholar Lawrence Douglas, who has just written a book, in fact, about what would happen if Trump refuses to leave the White House, in November. This isn't the only piece on this theme which has been published, and this has been kind of a talking point now for a while among the liberal left about the prospect of Trump refusing to leave that would cause some kind of constitutional crisis in November. And also he's given succor to this, or he's been seen to give succor to this, by his tweet suggesting that in the context that there'll be much more scope for electoral fraud in the context of significant mail voting in the November election due to the corona crisis. And this, so he suggested that the election should be delayed, and everyone obviously, like lemmings, kind of piled off the cliff that he had set up for them. So this is one, I mean, I suppose it's only to say that there's nothing particularly striking about this piece, because it's one of many, apart from the fact that it's an exemplar of the genre, because it's an interview with a leading legal constitutional scholar, and the fact that he's written this book called Will He Go? The detail, I mean, listeners, I suppose, can work through the detail themselves as to the various possible scenarios of what might happen in between the Electoral College or you know, if there's a very tight vote or if it's contested in particular counties or particular states. And, you know, I mean, this isn't the only scenario which has been played out. I suppose what's striking about it is, and what put me onto this is, I saw a satirical, a tweet by one of these satirical sites where it says people, words to the effect, the title was, the tweet was, people are afraid, people who refuse to accept the outcome of 2016 are worried that Trump won't accept the outcome of 2020. And I think it got to the quick.
Yeah.
In terms of speaking to all these kinds of this agonizing over whether Trump will go or not, speaks in fact of the bad faith of the Democratic Party and its supporters, who have done their utmost already to delegitimize the outcome of the earlier presidential election. And that's involved kind of not only with the kind of historical Russiagate nonsense that we've just talked about, but all, and you know, previously on the pod as well. And that it's involved so many kind of, that they've even kind of swept up sinister elements of the U.S. intelligence and security state in order to delegitimize the outcome of the 2016 election, but also to generally kind of undermine the electoral credibility of U.S. politics and its outcomes. And so I think this is the kind of the seamy underbelly of all of these debates, is the fact that the first people to make a significant push in the last few years to delegitimize electoral outcomes in the U.S. is the Democratic Party. Now, it's not to say that obviously I think what's happening here with Trump is he played a similar game in the run-up to 2016 when all the polls were against him. He made all sorts of claims about how Hillary, the Democrats, would steal the election. And the way I read that was not only was it him kind of seizing control of the news cycle as he's so good at doing through Twitter, but also he was playing it both ways, right? So if he had lost, which, you know, there were good chances that he could have lost in 2016, given the fact that it came down to a few thousand votes in significant constituencies for the Electoral College, that he was clearly kind of setting up a narrative that would have allowed him to remain a kind of public figure in the aftermath of an electoral defeat. And I think probably the same thing is going on here. And so he's willing, you know, I don't think he has any compunctions about damaging the kind of using his kind of insurrectionary persona to damage the credibility of the U.S. political system. But more to the point, he's not the only one who's done it. Whereas obviously the, you know, the kind of the way in which this is framed, both in this article, but elsewhere, is that this speaks to the unique menace that he poses to the fabric of American democracy. When in fact, I think it's, those opponents are those have deep and serried ranks on both sides of the aisle. And that it includes kind of sinister, you know, genuinely sinister aspects of the U.S. deep state on the Democratic side as well. And so that has to think, I think that has to be borne in when thinking about these kinds of debates.
Yeah. No, it was a good piece for discussion. I think there's a few points I'd make. One is that it's quite amusing. You sort of see this, the nightmare of Trump staying indefinitely in the, you know, Nobbs or Trump derangement syndrome. It won't finish with him leaving office. You know, there's going to be various recurrences and various kind of extensions of this kind of paranoia and worry that the liberal establishment have. But yeah, just one sort of paragraph that I wanted to flag up was what would the military do if Trump refused to accept defeat? You know, and then it says that Douglas, who wrote the book, spoke to a prominent general, and it's like you can clearly see the wish that there's kind of a good military coup, so replacing kind of the bad fascists with the good fascism and the good kind of the military stepping in on the right side. And it's just the whole thing comes across as pretty, yeah, like a projection and a pretty revealing kind of worry. To actually have written a whole book on this scenario, it is a bit strange. Is this what you want to happen? Because then it will be proved, you'll have been proved right about all of these things which Trump might have said. It's a kind of a strange position to be coming from on the part of the Democrats and their sort of various intellectual allies, but not a surprising one.
I suppose there is, another element, you know, one other thing which I thought was telling is the kind of John, when they talk about John King, so who is a news anchor. I mean, I guess he'll be familiar to our US listeners, a news anchor who operates CNN's so-called magic wall on election nights, who, you know, kind of reveals the results and when they make their inferences about who's won. And they say in this article about how everyone has become a John King. So, and that's dangerous to American democracy. So again, this kind of telling, I suppose, the telling reveal, the idea that the credibility of the experts who tell us, who kind of interpret, who tell, kind of read the runes for us of electoral statistics, and that the fact that this they no longer have that credibility is the fact that it's been massified, I suppose, is seen as damaging to American democracy. Again, I think a telling reveal. I suppose to put it in a broader context is only to say, you know, that given that both the Republicans and the Democrats now are happy to damage the credibility, the kind of democratic credibility and legitimacy of their own system in order to score partisan points, I think that speaks perhaps to a deeper crack up within the American state itself. It's kind of, you know, a unipolar system, which is so kind of the American empire, so sprawling and immense and conceited and decadent. And maybe, you know, I don't wish to overdo it. But in that context, where there is such little external pressure, or has been at least for such a long time in the aftermath of the Cold War, that now the two wings of the American elite feel that they can kind of tear chunks out of each other to this extent without being aware of how much they're imperiling their own kind of electoral and political basis, that they can attack each other in this way. You know, the Democrats can try seek to kind of overthrow an elected president effectively, come to the cusp of trying to mount a soft coup against elected president, that Trump can kind of stoke up conspiracy theories about the Democrats stealing the next election, and that both of them do this with seemingly kind of oblivious to the standing, to their own standing and to the position of the US in the world. That does tell you something about the degeneracy of the US ruling class as a whole, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, obviously, you're not in a situation, as this article seems to suggest is possible, that you might have a real rupture within the state, that, for example, the military might then have to come in and remove Trump from office, but maybe Trump has the support of, I don't know, some other bodies of armed men. I mean, that obviously isn't the case, and I think that's, you know, completely fantastical. Just to make the contrast, in Brazil, that very much is possible. you know, I'm not saying that it's very likely, but it's definitely possible. Whereas,
And it's happened. It's happened recently, is the point as well.
Yeah, exactly. You have constitutional ruptures, whereas in the US, you know, you haven't had that really. So, you know, since the Civil War. So, What I think, though, and where I slightly disagree with George, is that, I mean, although there might be a kind of, you know, wishful dystopia element to this book by Professor Douglas, I think he is far more reserved than his interviewer, you know, wants to lead him on to be. So, you know, he makes the point that, look, yeah, I don't really think Trump is going to not leave. Like, that's not a realistic possibility. What is possible, though, is the damage that he tries to do on his way out, that basically throws his toys out of the pram and tries to do as much damage as possible, both in advance of the election and sowing the seeds of the legitimacy of the result, and after leaving, you know, or in the process of leaving office, that he still keeps shrieking about unfairness, that he has his hardcore Trumpian base, which will cause difficulties, and that, as you say, you know, Phil, it's a, you know, it's a conspiracy from actually both sides to kind of undermine American democracy, even in its kind of liberal institutional form. And the irony of that, I guess, is that, you know, not so much the GOP itself, but, you know, at least under Trump, it's been really only the Democrats who've been left holding that candle. They're the party of institutionality, of running things the right way, of defense of the Republic, and so on. But you know, Phil's completely correct in pointing out that they've been complicit in undermining it just as much as the Trumpians have.
Yeah, and I think you're being a bit too sympathetic or too generous to the author of a book, Will He Go? I just think it's just it's very frustrating. The hypocrisy is just so fucking stark that they're like, oh, what damage could be done by questioning the institutions of American democracy and by questioning voting? And this is exactly the same sort of people, New Statesmen, and people like, I don't know the background of the author of the book, but even writing the book, I would assume
he's a legal academic.
Sort of, yeah, legal academic. They're exactly the sort of people who've been trying to undermine the election of Trump since 2016 and the Brexit vote as well. Obviously, have to mention that. And I just think that the whole, like, the advice to voters, it's so patronizing at the end of the article. Like, you need to vote to make sure that the result is decisive.
And which doesn't mean anything. Because you could vote for Trump and you have a very tight election with a very high turnout. Like, it doesn't mean anything.
Exactly. Senior political figures should warn the electorate about what is at stake in the election. It's like, fucking hell, that is just so, like, even to take that kind of route, it's so infuriating. And just think, these, you know, fuck these people. They're projecting their own disdain for democracy onto somebody who probably isn't its greatest fan. But I think it's just, I don't know. It's just, I mean, that's the point you made earlier, Phil. I think it's right that, you know, you should be rightly skeptical or dismissive of this kind of sort of pundit.
Yeah, I mean, I take your point. I think he makes, you know, he's more measured at any rate than it seems that the article wants to make out. That's my point. And he makes a point, you know, I think there's some correct points of you know, pundits on election night should say results provisional, not call the election. Because, of course, that's always a power move that networks declare in one way or another. It happened in 2000 to quite significant impact in electing George W. Bush. So, you know, it's hardly unseen. But I think it does speak to the kind of flimsiness of American institutions and American democracy right now.
He is more measured, but he's giving kind of, I mean, I think George is right. He's giving academic credibility to basically, you know, deeply the anti-democratic instincts of the liberal intelligentsia. I think that's right.
Well, anti-democratic, but specifically, you know, a kind of liberal constitutional approach to things, which, you know, it's interesting that he quotes Tom Stoppard's play, Jumpers. So it's not the voting that's democracy, it's the counting. That is to say, it's all the kind of checks and balances and to make sure that whatever voting happens, that it's done in that ways of follow the rules of the game, and that, you know, you have the courts who are able to intervene. Anyway, it's also it speaks to the constitutionalist.
And it's not actual it's not the idea of citizens en masse shaping the political process and participating politically.
Yeah.
But like you say, rather the kind of
the returning officer making sure that it's counted and it's all legitimate and done by the book.
And that kind of completely cuts against the final message, which is go out and do your duty, citizen, and make sure with the subtext of make sure you vote against Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, should we leave it here?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. All right, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this. I hope you found it useful. We're always willing to take some suggestions as well, so feel free to send them in. I know some of you have for this last one, but in some of those cases, we found them a little bit too long and involved to discuss in this format, but we'll try to return to those. And I hope that doesn't dissuade you from sending in future suggestions. All right, that's it for now. Catch you later. Bye-bye.